From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, when the Trump administration announced deportation raids in major U.S. cities, communities were thrown into a panic.
That's incredibly irresponsible. That is bad policy. That is creating a dangerous, fractured community where people are afraid to go to work, afraid to go to school, afraid to report crimes they see in the street.
Emilio De Torre from the ACLU of Wisconsin explains how to ensure your rights are protected when dealing with law enforcement. Later, we'll learn about body-based treatments for PTSD, and automotive contributor Mark Savage explains why the classic sedan is becoming more popular.
You can get a nice sedan for $25,000. These are things that are loaded and comfortable and easy to get a family of four, maybe five in, depending on the size, and hey, it's a bargain out there, and most of them get really good gas mileage also.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Many people in America are living in fear. As the Trump administration continues to stoke fears over immigration raids, there's some confusion over the rights guaranteed to all people in the United States, regardless of immigration status. Emilio De Torre is the director of community engagement at the ACLU of Wisconsin, and he regularly gives talks to groups about how to interact with law enforcement while preserving their own rights. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about his work.
It's important for everyone to know that the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and our state constitution apply to everybody. And obviously, that's why the ACLU exists, right? People are frequently attempting to deny people equal access to rights. And a big part of what our trainings are, they inform people who are in typically marginalized communities what their rights are, especially if historically those rights haven't been respected or they've been stepped on or they've been told that they don't have these rights even though they do. These rights could be know your rights during a police encounter. These rights could be know your rights during any governmental encounter. But now especially we're getting a lot of requests for knowing your rights during ICE or immigration encounters. And what does that look like? Some people, it seems, like to believe that if you are, or they imagine at least, that if you visit another country like the United States or any country, magically you have no rights. You're just kind of floating there. And that's wrong, and that's disgraceful, and it's un-American to think that and to perpetuate that. When we're talking about know your rights if ICE encounters you, either in your workplace or on the street, that's really important to know because the stakes are high. And there's a lot of fear and a lot of misconceptions with what people can do and don't do. One common misconception that folks have here in Wisconsin especially is that police can interrogate your child or a young person, whether you're a citizen or not, and hold them accountable for the things that they say. And I like to bring that up as an example because I think it has a very visceral impact in mothers and fathers and people that, you know, recall how fragile a child's life is. And when they're being interrogated by police or federal government official, that's terrifying. Here are adults with guns and weapons telling you that you can get in trouble and all of these bad things can happen to you. And that is a disgusting imbalance of power. And when the stakes then might be that this child is afraid that their parent, who may be an asylum seeker or refugee or an immigrant or maybe a citizen and doesn't speak English well enough, or a citizen and they're worried that because their name is, you know, Emilio De Torre, that their mom or dad is going to get in trouble because of the color of the skin or how many vowels are in their name. And so they're terrified, and this is very real.
That kind of speaks to the general imbalance that we see in so many of these interactions, specifically when we're talking about immigrants who don't have legal status. There is a kind of feeling of, well, what are my rights? So I'd like to go through some scenarios. You know, if you are somebody, regardless of immigration status, who has been stopped on the street by a police officer or law enforcement more generally, what should you keep in mind?
Sure. The most important thing is that you do not need to speak to law enforcement. If it's an ICE agent or a police agent, you don't have to speak to them unless you're driving a car or you don't have to present your driver's license. You should never present false documentation. You know, guaranteed, underline that in red. So if you've got a fake driver's license, you're an underage drinker, you're presenting some sort of license that you have that you're using that's just baloney, don't present that. And know that you're going to be held accountable for anything you say. So lots of times people feel that they need to protest their innocence. Or, you know, I've seen seasons 1 through 5 of CSI. I know how to handle this. And that's nonsense because generally this is the first time a person has had this encounter with law enforcement, whatever that law enforcement might be. They're banking on the fact that they know that you're nervous, your heart is beating quicker, you don't understand why you're being stopped, you want to protest your innocence, and they begin to say foolish things and things for which they can be held culpable. And so it's really important that they don't say anything, and they have to assert their right to remain silent. So they say, I don't wish to talk to you. The converse side of that is people feel like they're going to be assumed that they're guilty for not speaking, or won't the police assume that I'm guilty if I tell them they can't search my car?
Well, and it seems like, at least in some of these situations, having watched videos, that police officers will say that to the people they've stopped. Well, you know, if you're innocent, then, you know, why aren't you talking to me?
It's so common. So that's an example of verbal judo. The police have had this encounter 20 to 30, 40, 50 times a day. And so they know what to say to get you to go. It's just like playing chess or martial arts. You know, if you faint here, you're probably going to do this next and that next. If you move your pawn here, this is probably the next step you have. And so they know that if they imply guilt, why can't I search your car? Do you have drugs or something? The implication then is that you're a drug smuggler. And the anxiety and anguish you feel that you're going to get some sort of, you know, midnight cowboy punishment behind this is brutal. And so people then waive their rights and allow police or law enforcement to search things. And we also don't know. I mean, just take a look at what was circulating all over the news last week about the officer intentionally planting meth on people that he wanted to stop, or the officer in Maryland who is planting crack cocaine on folks, or the officers who carry dummy guns and throw dummy guns around. So maybe they don't like your face, or you don't know that officer that's stopping you. Why gamble with your freedom and your life? They already think you look guilty. That's why they stopped you out of the thousands of other people. So using that as a presupposition, you want to get home safe and healthy to be with your family.
So you don't have to talk to someone unless you've been stopped in a vehicle. What do you have to say if you've been stopped in a vehicle?
So if you've been stopped in a vehicle, it's really important that people maintain their composure. They turn off their radio. They put their hands on the steering wheel at 10 and 2, just like they learned in driver's ed. They've turned off their car. And then they wait for the officer to engage them. They have to have a license and you know, proof of registration or insurance. And if the officer asks for these things, I like to say, officer, I keep my registration in the glove compartment. I'm going to reach over there and grab my registration. Is that okay? They may ask you if you have any weapons in the car, and you should let them know that if you have weapons in the car so that they don't shoot you or freak out if they see that you've got a gun that you have a license for that's in the glove compartment or something somewhere. And you should just answer their questions and not volunteer anymore. So if an officer, for example, says, do you know why I pulled you over? Politely say, officer, maybe you should tell me why you pulled me over, as opposed to giving them different examples of why they should have perhaps pulled you over or just blathering. Police officers can order your passengers out of the car, but your passengers don't really have to identify themselves, and they shouldn't. And listen, just because these are your rights don't mean that they're going to just accept your answers. They may be rude. They may be aggressive. They may be brusque. They may say cruel things. They may speak out of name. It's very important to remember that you always have the right to videotape law enforcement. You should, if you feel threatened, you should record this. I recommend that maybe you put this on Facebook Live. If you are a passerby, you may want to record this and draw attention to it or not, depending on whether or not you're quick. Unprofessional assessment is that I'm hopefully going to alleviate harm of this person to let law enforcement know that I'm watching this and documenting it. And that's with ICE too. You need to share this information. Sometimes there's a lot of misinformation that I've seen as recently as this morning, where people see a guy in a black SUV and assume they're ICE, or see like an organ transport vehicle and they don't know that that's an organ transport vehicle even though it says it, and they jump to conclusions. Or people say, oh, undercovers are here. It's important that you document and share these things in a way that doesn't generate fear, that gets the story out, and then maybe draw some clarity to it. Definitely record. Only the driver presents these information. The rest of the folks should be quiet. If the officer says something that you believe to be a lie or wrong, make a mental note of the officer's name, their badge, their ID, the car, the location, where you got stopped, and then file a complaint with the Fire and Police Commission here in Milwaukee, the Police and Fire Commission in Madison, or or whomever, the ACLU is happy to let you know where you can find some accountability.
You just mentioned, you know, an organ transplant vehicle that people kind of confused and thought might be ICE. When it comes to law enforcement, whether it's a police department or ICE or Border Patrol, what do they need to show you so you know who they are?
That's a trickier question because much to the consternation of good law enforcement officers across the country, and we're talking sheriffs, deputies, police chiefs, ICE has been acting in a dishonorable way where they're pretending to be police and law enforcement and showing up at people's houses or showing up on the street with jackets that say police on the back when in fact that they're ICE. And that's deplorable because somebody may, you know, who cares if you're a refugee or asylum seeker or an unauthorized immigrant? You're still a part of that community and you care about what's happening to your neighbors. And you may think, oh, my neighbor might be in problem, or the old lady or a man that lives next to me, something may have happened to them. Let me see if I can help. And now you get deported because you open the door because you're answering ICE, who's in disguise. So if an ICE agent knocks on your door, demand to see a warrant that's signed by a judge. Now, there's a trick here, too, because they'll print these things called administrative warrants. And that's baloney, right? Like, that's me printing a diploma online and just having my colleague or one of my two intern friends here sign that and say, this now makes it official because my coworker signed this. That's nonsense. So it should say Honorable Judge so-and-so, and look for that. If you're a Spanish speaker, honorable and honorable are the same word, and you'll see that that makes sense. You can find these examples online. There are great resources. Surely, Joy, we're only going to touch the tip of the iceberg here, but CasaTheMaryland.org has a very comprehensive document that explains how to make a plan with your family for safety, how to get which documents you need. If you're worried about getting legal representation, the American Immigration Lawyers Association has some great Know Your Rights documents, and they encourage the hot link to forms like a G28 form, which will allow you to get legal representation if you do get caught up and detained. There's so many important things to know during these times that you want to make a plan of safety for your family. You want to demand to see a warrant. If it's and have them slide it under the door, hold it up to the keyhole, and then don't let folks in and don't speak to them. You don't have to say anything. And they may try to trick you. Maybe ICE shows up at your workplace and they say, okay, we just have some routine questioning. Everybody who is a citizen, stand to the left. Everybody who is an immigrant, stand to the right. You don't have to comply. You just go stand in a third place. Stay where you're standing. If you're working in a place that has both private and public areas, like maybe it's a church, maybe it's a temple, maybe it's a mosque, you have a public area for convening, fine. Law enforcement, ICE agents can come in there. But you have private areas where you're running Bible studies or you have a daycare or it's where, you know, folks meet for more private, like wedding counseling or something. Make sure that they know that they can't go there. And that's private. And if they don't have a signed warrant, they don't get to go there. It's very important that we show what we are really about as a country and stand up for our brothers and sisters at this moment now.
What are the kinds of rights you have if you are a temple or church or mosque?
So the ACLU has some interesting white pages on that, and we're happy to share that. And certainly we've been traveling around the state meeting with very interested people who hear echoes of what happened during the 30s and 40s in Europe happening now. And they're much stronger than echoes, right? So congregations and people of faith have been meeting to talk about a variety of things. How do they show that their morality, that their religious faith applies to their deeds as well? So they've been talking about making sure that they're open and welcoming. They've been identifying themselves as sanctuaries. They've been active in the community, letting people know that hate has no home here. They're doing trainings to find out. They create their own rapid responses and rapid responders. And there are dozens and dozens of these across the state where if people identify what they think is an ICE incursion in their community, then they're working with citizens who care to send citizens there to identify the problem, to question the suspected threat, to ask why these people are there, to document them, to photo them, to let them know that this is not appropriate for our community or our state. And there's a lot of that. They've been training community members, making sure that they have people that speak the languages of the impacted population on staff, identifying what is public and private, making sure that they're stepping up security so that people can't just walk into private areas like a daycare, which was a big issue. When you're a welcoming faith, like many of the temples and churches and mosques we have here, they have this very open, warm identity in a neighborhood. And so it bothers them that they have to protect their congregations in such a way where they feel like they have to change this open, warm identity that they have and now begin to question people that are showing up that look official or question people that they're worried are going to rip members of their faith congregations away. And I've had this conversation with, you know, you pick a religion, they've reached out to us and they've wanted to know how they can help and what they can do.
And that's especially concerning when you're talking about a daycare. No one wants to imagine that they leave their three-year-old and now they have to worry about them at this church.
Yeah. Or worry about them during the pickup. Like it's mommy and daddy are more worried about what that looks like going to pick up. And the thing is, how do we balance this and not create an atmosphere of fear? Because I think a big secondary target of the Trump administration is to create fear and is to create unrest. Look at how these, and I'm going to use the word raids in quotes, has been unleashed now in news. That's incredibly irresponsible. That is bad policy. That is creating a dangerous, fractured community where people are afraid to go to work, afraid to go to school, afraid to report crimes they see in the street. It's making people tense. It's making it so that people aren't going to get the medical treatment that they need. And that's affecting businesses. I mean, just take a look at the buying power of these communities. You know, $10.2 billion for Asian folks in Wisconsin. I think it's $11 billion for Latinx folks in Wisconsin. How responsible is that? Just economically speaking, that's ridiculous. People are looking for ways to get involved. And I think that people should figure out locally what the best solution is. People that are closest to the problem are closest to the solution. And if there's a way that they can meet with the people in their community specifically, they can always contact groups like the ACLU of Wisconsin, American Immigration Lawyers Association. I find many teachers and professors getting involved. A lot of artists are working to elevate this message. People are telling and sharing their stories on social media. It would be beautiful to see more of that happening. I think we as a people, having this type of discourse on the radio, meeting in community forums, having these people are not accepting this. And so we need to come together and show other folks, sometimes for the first time, hey, you're different from me, but you have a right to be here too, and I respect you.
Yeah. Well, Emilio, thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of your work.
It was a pleasure to come here. Thanks for inviting me.
Emilio De Torre is the Director of Community Engagement at the ACLU of Wisconsin. He spoke with Joy Powers. You can find a link to more resources from the ACLU and other groups by going to wuwm.com. Coming up after a break, we'll talk with a Milwaukee-based therapist about body-based treatments for PTSD. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We hear the phrase trauma-informed care a lot these days. People who have endured childhood abuse or battlefield conditions often suffer from PTSD and find it difficult to set the trauma aside. Care that takes that past trauma into account helps patients feel more comfortable and in control. Treating the PTSD itself is also evolving. Joshua Delahan is a licensed clinical social worker and a psychotherapist in Milwaukee. He uses a number of what's called body-based modalities to help people resolve trauma, especially something called brain spotting. Delahan joins us in the studio now to tell us more, starting with a clinical definition of trauma.
There's actually only one thing that creates trauma. And most people don't know that. Actually, a lot of therapists don't understand that, which is interesting. Most of my students had never heard this concept before. But the research comes out of actually working with animals that, unfortunately, there's lots of research done with animals and putting them in different stressful situations. And the research comes out of the fact that when an animal gets really stressed out and they're immobilized at the same time, they tend to have a response coming out of that immobilized state that is an excessive release of energy. And so
we might say panicked.
Yeah, panicked, yeah. Exactly. So when we see humans and they go through a stressful situation and they're immobilized at the same time, whether it's they go into a freeze state or whether they actually are physically held down and immobilized, when they have the fear plus immobilization, within gets created this this memory, this body memory, this self state that has all the hormones that are going on during that time, the stress hormones, the adrenaline, all of those things, the beliefs that we have about ourselves that we're helpless, all of those things get kind of locked into that body memory. And some people call it a trauma capsule or a dissociation capsule. Some people call it a self state. But that's what trauma is. It's immobilization plus fear. And that's all that creates trauma. And that can be when you're in wartime as a soldier. It can be being at home when the dog is biting you. It can be lots of different things that create that immobilization plus fear. But that's all that creates trauma.
And so when that happens, whatever the situation is that's creating that, carrying it on, I assume, is the issue. That when we don't let that go, we're unable to release that energy.
Yes. So it's a physiological response that has psychological consequences. So what happens is all of those physiological responses, whenever we're triggered, whenever there's something in our environment that triggers that body memory, that self state, that trauma capsule, all of that comes back to us. And so that's what we call PTSD, the flashbacks, the night terrors. All of those things are just the body and lower brain sending those signals and you having the experience up in your top level of your brain of kind of being out of control. And so that's what we call PTSD. And so it starts in the body and lower brain, and then those signals get sent up to the upper brain, and then we have to try to make meaning of that. And so that's the only time that our thinking brain actually becomes involved, is when those signals are sent up from the lower parts of our body and brain.
Interesting. So when we're in a PTSD situation, having a flashback or something like that, this is not a conscious thing until we're recognizing we're in the middle of it.
Exactly. Because we're getting all these signals. Our heart is racing. We're having these images, these smells, all of those things that come back when you're in that self state. And then now our thinking brain has to make some kind of sense of that. And we get very freaked out by that. And then it becomes a kind of a loop. So we get freaked out by that. What's going on? And now we're in panic. And it's sending the signal back down to the lower part of our brain that's recognizing threat and fear. And it's sending it back up. And so it's kind of a loop that happens until we can calm ourselves down and get out of that state.
Have the kinds of therapies used to help people deal with this changed over time?
Absolutely. So in the beginning, a couple hundred years ago, people were just assuming that there was some defect, something wrong with the person, and they weren't really getting any treatment except for putting them in a house, separating them away from people. Then there started to be, with Freud doing just kind of talk therapy, they used hypnosis to help. Hypnosis actually can access the lower part of the brain, and so that was actually helpful for some people. And then they started to do medications, kind of like in the mid-20th century. And then they started to use cognitive and behavioral types of therapies. Body-based therapies started to come into the scene maybe about 30 or 40 years ago. Peter Levine was probably one of the first people that used body-based therapies, and then other people have developed them past that. He's still around, and he's still doing great work with somatic experiencing, and that's one of the types of therapies that I definitely recommend that people use. So it's been lots of different ways that people have tried to treat it. Originally, there was a lot of stigma tied to it, and there still is to some extent. So once we realized that everybody can go through a situation where they're immobilized and have fear, and then they have consequences from that, if we just realize that's kind of a natural state that we go into, then maybe we can start realizing, then maybe there's something that we can do to try to just get out of that and kind of deprogram our mind and body from doing that anymore.
I don't want to simplify this too much, but it almost sounds like we need to recognize it as something as primitive as you're hungry and you need to eat.
That's really what it is. As soon as you can recognize those inner sensations and be able to sit with those and be able to experience those in the presence of somebody that's a helpful, supportive person to you, and it doesn't always have to be, but it's really helpful to have that person because the nature of trauma is that we're alone in that. That we're experiencing it internally by ourselves and nobody is helping us with that. That's where the immobilization comes from. And so when we're in the presence of an attuned person, our brain is able to open up and release that self state, release those sensations, and release that energy that's stuck when we're in trauma.
You're a specialist in body-based therapies and helping people with trauma. And it sounds like from the timeline that you just gave us that we went from basically neglect to brain-based therapies or mind-based therapies. Yeah. But you're saying the issue is actually a body-based issue and we're only recently using the body as a way to heal the issue.
Exactly. So it's really easy to think that trauma is a psychological problem because people who have trauma have lots of psychological issues. If you look at the DSM-5, the treatment manual that says all the different disorders, you could probably link a majority of those diagnoses to trauma. Not that that trauma causes all of them, but there's a huge link between trauma and many of those diagnoses. Anxiety for sure, depression, all of these things can have a base of trauma. And so when we start to look at trauma as a biological issue and a lower brain issue and not a psychological, not that you can talk your way out of it or think your way out of it, then we start getting to what actually was happening in the moment of trauma, which was my body and lower brain were overwhelmed. We're in this state of panic and freeze. And when we can go back to that, then we can actually resolve it instead of just trying to talk our way out of it and saying, I'm strong enough. I don't have to think this way. I don't have to feel this way. Your brain isn't actually set up to do that. Your upper part of your brain, your neocortex, actually has a barrier to your lower brain. It doesn't have an influence as much as we might think on our lower brain and a body.
It sounds like we're asking our will to take over where it really can't.
Will is very strong, and will gets us to the office, right? Will gets us to the therapy office or gets us to reading that book that might help us kind of work through our issues. But will cannot on its own resolve the trauma. Resolving the trauma means you uncouple the fear from the immobilization. That's literally all you have to do to resolve the trauma. And that's, you know, per single trauma. If you have somebody who has developmental trauma when they were a baby and they were abused or neglected, that gets very complicated because now you're talking about influencing brain structure and influencing relational issues because usually they're neglected by somebody who's supposed to be taking care of them. And so that gets more complicated. We call that complex trauma. And there's even more complications that happen from that, dissociation, multiple personalities, which we call dissociative identity disorder. These things come from those original traumas. And so the younger it is, the more complex it usually is. And the more times it happened, the more complex it is. But if we're talking a single event trauma where I was in a car accident and now when I get into the car, I have a panic attack, you can use one of these body-based therapies to go to that moment, open up that file, release that self-state, all that energy, uncouple the fear from the immobilization, get back into your car right after the session and drive away, and you're fine.
Okay, so let's talk about some of these body-based therapies.
Yeah.
What are some of the tools that you use?
So I was first trained in somatic experiencing. Peter Levine is the originator of somatic experiencing. He's been doing it for about 40 years or so. And I basically just read several of his books and I had a supervisor at my first job that was also trained in it. And so he could supervise me to use these skills. Somatic experiencing basically is where you have the person bring up the issue, whatever the issue is, or actually just come into the office and notice what's going on inside their body. Sometimes we don't even have to bring up the issue. It's just, it's always there. And so the issue gets brought up. We have them notice what physical sensations do you have in your body right now? Do you have energy in your legs? Is your heart racing? You know, what's going
on?
Sweating. Yeah. All these different symptoms that we have when we're triggered. And then we just have them in the attuned presence of the therapist, notice those things as they come up. And just be with them and allow them because we're used to pushing them down, dissociating those things. But we have this situation with a therapist where we can actually just allow that to happen.
We're safe.
Yeah. And the major point of somatic experiencing is the resource. So whenever we're traumatized in our body, there's a place in our body that's not activated with all of this other adrenaline, all these things, there's a place in our body that's actually safe and calm and neutral. And so with the somatic experiencing, what they do is they have you notice the sensations that are uncomfortable, and then they have you go back to a place in your body where you feel comfortable. And then you just titrate back and forth between those two. And as you do that, you kind of pendulate, the activation part goes down. So we have this term called SUDS, which is subjective units of disturbances scale. And that's like a 0 to 10 scale. How much do you feel that? you know, heart pounding in your chest, 0 to 10. And it might start out at a 10 or a 5 or whatever it is. But as you go back and forth between the resource and that activation, that number will go down and eventually it will be gone. And so you won't feel the tension in your shoulders anymore. You won't feel that heart racing and that will be gone. You've uncoupled the fear from the immobilization and then that trauma, that specific trauma is resolved.
One of the things that you also work with is a technique called brain spotting.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something I confess I had never heard of. I've heard of somatic imaging but I've never heard of brain spotting. So how does that differ from what you just described?
Yeah. So after I did somatic experiencing, my supervisor also was trained in what's called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. So when I was in graduate school at UWM, they had a video that they showed of EMDR, just a session of EMDR. And after that video, I decided I was definitely going to get trained in it because it seemed like something that was very effective for the person that was in the video. So I got trained in that as well. I'm getting to brain spotting through EMDR. So EMDR was created by Francine Shapiro in 1989. And what it is it's taking the same concept of somatic experiencing, of noticing those physical sensations in your body. But she found out that if you move your eyes back and forth in a pendulating way, that if you notice the feeling in your body and you have your eyes kind of going back and forth, kind of bilaterally stimulating your brain, that suds goes down as well. And she had no idea originally why that happened. She was just interested in it. She was a psychologist and working with clients, vets. And so she started using it with some of her clients and saying, just watch my finger go back and forth and notice, you know, the sensations in your body. And so she noticed that they were getting a lot of healing. And so she created a protocol around that where you talk about the negative self-beliefs that you have about the trauma, like it was my fault or things like that. And then you come up with a positive belief that you want to have about yourself, like I lived through it, I'm strong enough to survive, something like that. And then you bring up the issue, you notice the sensations in your body, and then you do the eye movements back and forth until that goes down to a zero suds. And then you can talk about, okay, how much do you believe that negative belief anymore? Well, I don't believe it at all. Well, how much do you believe the positive belief? Well, it's 1 to 7. I don't know why it's a 1 to 7 scale. 1 to 7, I believe I'm like a 5. All right, let's see if we can get it up to a 7. What's blocking that from a 7? Then you continue to do the eye movements until that goes up to a 7. So they've uncoupled the immobilization from the fear, and now you're working on this belief of that I'm okay.
Sort
that
of replacing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then you strengthen that. And at the end of that, that trauma is resolved completely.
So when you say the trauma is resolved, does it ever come up again? Or does it tend to truly be resolved? Like it just, you're not panicked around that anymore.
Yeah. So my experiences with my clients are, there might be a little tiny piece that they didn't get to during the session. Sometimes your brain continues to process after you leave the session. It continues to go, and then eventually you'll get to all of it. But sometimes there's like a little stuck piece that they have to come back and do. But for, like I said, a single event trauma, a car accident, being mugged or something like that, you mostly will be able to resolve that within 1 or 2 sessions. You'll get to all of that self-state that you need to resolve it. And then you don't have any nightmares. You don't have any flashbacks. You don't have any of those symptoms of PTSD anymore because the self-state doesn't exist. You released it and it's gone. So from EMDR actually comes brain spotting. So David Grand was an EMDR therapist. He wrote books about EMDR. He was a consultant. He was very kind of high up in the EMDR world. And he was doing EMDR with one of his clients. And as he was doing the eye movements, he noticed that at one spot, the person's eyes kind of froze and like wobbled, and then it would continue. And in EMDR, they have this thing where you're moving your fingers across. And then if they do that, you're supposed to like tap your fingers a little bit so that they like to snap them out of it basically and then keep on going, right? But he thought, well, I wonder if there's something like about looking at that spot that's different. And so he just held his finger there where they were wobbling and freezing. And then all of a sudden, this information started coming out, things that they had already processed with EMDR, processed to a deeper level. And the thing that they were processing in that moment processed all the way down to the bottom of a zero. And so he's like, well, that's really interesting. And so then he started trying that. When he would find those little wobbles, he was still doing EMDR, but he would find the wobbles, he would freeze and stop on that spot, and they would process way more. And so he realized that there must be something about looking at a specific spot in your field of vision that helps your brain process more. And so he wondered about that. And so he started looking up different articles, working with neuroscientists, people who study the brain and why that might be. And what they came up with, Frank Corrigan, who is a neuroscientist in Scotland, came up with the hypothesis that when we are in a traumatic state, when we're in a stressed out state, we're orienting towards safety. We're trying to look for a place to go to get out of that situation because, you know, you've heard of flight, fight, freeze. That's the order that we go. We're either fighting or flighting or running, or we're fighting. If we can't get out of the situation, we're fighting our way out or we freeze up. So we're always orienting towards safety. And so the idea was that if we find that spot of safety and you're with that attuned person, feeling safe with that attuned person, it actually accesses the part of your lower brain that's holding this self state. It actually opens up and allows that self state to be released.
So it's making that connection between the higher and lower brains that you were saying there's a barrier.
Yeah, there. You're actually surpassing the neocortex by using an eye position because eye position goes directly into your lower brain.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very, very cool.
Yeah.
And so I'm assuming this is a very effective therapy for releasing both simple and complex traumas.
Yes.
How regarded is it? How accepted is it within the therapeutic community?
Yeah. So I was actually really curious about like how many people have been trained in and how many people have been trained in somatic experiencing and EMDR and other body-based therapies. And so I just did a cursory kind of search about like the numbers of people. And in America, there are 550,000 therapists, you know, general therapists. And then about 50 to 60,000 of them are body-based therapists, but that's only about 10%, right? So the reason why that is, one of the reasons why that is because EMDR has been researched, clinical research, the most out of any trauma resolution therapy. And so that's the most widely used. More people are trained in EMDR than any other body-based therapies. But it's still, if you add everybody together, it's only 10%. And so the reason is because there isn't a lot of clinical gold standard research around somatic experiencing and brain spotting. Brain spotting is young. It's only since 2003. And it's very difficult to get funding for this type of research. If there were infinite resources to do that,
yeah,
there would be much more, you know, robust research around brain spotting. But one of the issues is this idea of evidence-based practice. And we want to have evidence-based practice because it's been tried and tested. And we know that it works. And one of the things is when something is emerging type of therapy, there isn't a lot of evidence. So we have to go on the other two legs of evidence-based practice. One of the legs is research, and that's a very important leg. The other two are the therapist's observations of what they're seeing in their clients when they're using the new type of therapy, and then the actual client's response. So if we take those two pieces of evidence with EMDR, somatic experiencing, brain spotting, we're seeing huge results with that. So unfortunately, we have to catch up with the research side of it. And so it's not as well regarded because of the lack of research about it. But unfortunately, even in our own school, I went to the researchers and said, hey, you know, you study anxiety. You know, what do you think about studying brain spotting? It's been very effective. I've been using it for, you know, 5 or 6 years and had amazing results. And the person actually said that there are so many bottles of shampoo on the shelf, we don't need another bottle of shampoo, meaning there are too many trauma therapies. We don't want to add to that. And I couldn't believe the response because of the results that I see with my clients. I mean, I have vets that come in with flashbacks and nightmares, night terrors, and they do one session of brain spotting and the night terror never returns. Like, that's the type of results you get.
You would think you would want to research that.
Absolutely.
If you're getting that kind of empirical evidence, you know, just like, this is my day-to-day experience.
Exactly.
Let's see if we replicate that in the lab.
Yeah. And that's really why I'm sitting here, because I am seeing these incredible results. I have, you know, hundreds of brain spotters that I've been in trainings with and things that have been seeing all these results. You know, why isn't there more research on it? Why isn't there more of a focus on these body-based therapies when they're so effective? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe just it's the number of resources and the people who are doing other types of therapies have kind of an in on the resources, I guess. I don't really know the answer to that. I wish I did. I'm not really a researcher per se. I'm more of a clinician. So that's not really my side of things, but I wish there were. I mean, if they would just do, you know, two huge research studies on brain spotting, I'm sure they would show the results are fantastic and it would be more widely accepted.
Well, I'm very glad you came in to tell us about it. It has been a great conversation, Josh. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Josh Delahan is an instructor of psychology and ethics at Waukesha County Technical College, as well as an adjunct professor for the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. In his private practice, he's trained in EMDR, somatic experiencing, and brain spotting, among other modalities. There's more information at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then our automotive contributors join us to praise the sedan. Lake Effect returns with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Trucks and SUVs and crossovers, oh my, what is a poor sedan to do? There was a time when sedans were kings of the road. If you needed more cargo room, you just bought a station wagon. But those days are long gone. Trucks, SUVs, and crossovers have reigned supreme basically since the gas shortages of the 1970s. But sedans have been quietly doing their thing this whole time, getting us from point A to point B without any fanfare besides the occasional headline. And while there are fewer sedan choices these days, the remaining ones have had to put up their game to stay competitive. Automotive contributors Dan Harmon and Mark Savage join Lake Effect now to discuss where sedans fit in the current marketplace.
Something that I've noticed is as the Chryslers and Fords in particular and GM to a certain degree have decided to cut back on their sedans, that as I've gone through car shows and various events in the last 6 months, everybody else is talking up sedans. So I just think it's kind of funny. I mean, I guess sedans make up about 25% of the marketplace right now and cars overall about 30% of the marketplace. So that's 5 to 6 million vehicles out there that are being sold. And, you know, if you start chopping out two or three of those makes, that leaves, let's say, 240, 250,000, maybe more, maybe 300,000 sales for the other car makers. So it's not too surprising to see the, in my mind, the Nissans and the Volkswagens kind of step forward and say, hey, we're going to keep doing sedans and get some of that market share.
And when you said you heard them all talking up sedans, are they talking them up because there's going to be a return of sedans, or they're just talking it up because they're talking about their new models of sedan?
Well, I'm sure of both. But Nissan was generous enough to share some of their survey information with us. And you know, I don't know how many people they surveyed, but nonetheless, they were happy with this. And if they're churning their business this way, I got a feeling they're pretty strong on this. But they said 78% of non-sedan buyers that they had surveyed would consider buying one for their next car. And 86% of millennials, which obviously is a growing part of the market right now, would consider it. And 8 of 10 of the millennials that are single parents said that sedans were on their shopping list. And it just makes sense in that sedans, generally speaking, at least for now, are a good bargain, because it used to be little pickup trucks were the bargain, and now those cost $40,000 and $50,000, as do the bigger trucks, $50,000 and $60,000. And crossovers are kind of in between there a little bit, but you can get a nice sedan for $25,000, and if you want a really nice one, to $45,000. So these are things that are loaded and comfortable and easy to get a family of four, maybe five in, depending on the size. And, hey, it's a bargain out there. And most of them get really good gas mileage also.
And what's occurred to me about sedans is that as they become less a part of the market, or already have, that the ones that are left are going to have to be better. So in some ways, there are less sedans, there are fewer of them, but they're getting better.
Right. And that's what you're seeing right now with the Volkswagen. I just drove the Arteon. And with Nissan, I've driven the Altima and the Maxima and I think the Sentra earlier this year too. And they're all quieter than they used to be. They put some more sound deadening into these so that they seem, you know, maybe a little more luxurious, even if that's not what you would consider the car to be. And they handle well. And most of them have, you know, a reasonable amount of power. Some have the turbo engines now because turbos, of course, have become so popular to increase, you know, the power ratings for all the cars. And almost everything now has all the safety equipment that, you know, when you and I were talking maybe 3 and 4 years ago, it was brand new that they had backup cameras and lane departure warnings and assists. And in fact, a number of the cars now have this thing that if you engage cruise control, it helps steer the car while you're driving in cruise control. And so you get near a line on the road and it starts to push the car back into the middle. And that's just automatic these days. So when you can get that on a, let's say, $30,000 to $35,000 sedan, why should I pay $35,000 to $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 for something bigger and heavier and maybe less efficient? And I'm just as safe, if not safer, as long as I don't run into a truck.
And how much of this, I guess I'm going to call it re-interest or new interest in sedans, is economics? And how much of it is perhaps a rejection of trucks or a rejection of SUVs or a rejection of crossovers?
I don't think so much would be the rejection of the crossovers and the trucks. I'm sure, you know, a few people may go that route. But I really think it's going to be driven by economics, because the trucks that used to be economical are no longer economical. So you want to, you know, if you're a single parent with one or two kids, or if you're, you know, a young family and you're looking for, you know, inexpensive wheels, but you want the safety devices on your car and you want it to be a nice, you know, comfortable car to take a trip in, man, the sedans are just, you know, they're screaming at you to say, look at my price tag, because that's so much less. I mean, the average price of a new car, they say, is $36,000 and a truck is $46,000. That's a big difference just if you're getting the average car, and that's, you know, meaning I'm not getting the base one. So the base models are anywhere from $22,000 to $28,000 now, and while that's not cheap, it's a whole lot less expensive than getting a, you know, entry-level SUV or certainly a pickup truck these days.
Are you lumping hatchbacks into the sedan category? Or are they their own thing? Just because those are even cheaper than sedans, but they pretty much behave like a sedan, just as low.
And I agree with you. They are pretty much like sedans, and they don't count the same in the numbers that when they start doing all the addition for the car companies. But again, you know, maybe that's 5% of the market out there. But to you and I know that really like the hatchbacks. You know, I would probably get a hatchback over a sedan just for styling purposes, and I just love being able to flip up the hatch and toss as much as I want in the back. But again, sedans or hatchbacks certainly are both in the same category for the same kind of pricing and you know, same kind of value.
I guess I'm curious as to what automakers are doing to entice people into buying sedans, or is that not how they're viewing it?
I don't think all the automakers are doing that, because obviously if you were starting to phase these out over the – actually, I think by the end of this model year, most of these will be phased out by Ford and Chrysler outside of – I think they got the Charger and the Mustang. But I think what you're going to see is that marketing efforts will probably pick up by some of the car makers. Like I say, Nissan tells us they're trying to redo their whole lineup basically in the next year or two. And when they had a new Sentra, Altima, and Maxima, and Versa last year and this year, or 19 and 20, you know, you're going to see them pushing those a lot harder than they had been in the past. And Volkswagen's got a new Passat, and the Jetta is fairly new, and the Arteon. So you're going to see those. Just off the top of my head here, I think Subaru has a new WRX. The Legacy was new about a year ago. Hyundai has an Elantra. So you're seeing remakes of cars that have been out there for a while, but they'll have more and more of this the safety equipment on it. And again, they haven't jacked the prices way up on these things yet, because I'm assuming they feel that they can't get that. But as soon as people start buying them, then the price will start going up. So I'm just saying, this is, you know, be a market leader, go for one of these now and get a good price and get a nice car. And the other thing that we had mentioned before the show here was that only a few cars, sedans, actually increased in sales last year, but they were substantial, and that was the Camry and the Honda Civic and the Nissan Sentra. So those were all up. Those are all top six cars in the selling of around the country. In fact, Camry's been number one for quite a while now. So if those are gaining popularity, I think that's a good overall sign that if you keep your cars current and keep them up to date with all the safety technology, that people are happy to buy them and save a little money and probably save a little on gas and so forth down the road.
Yeah, I think there's always going to be a certain percentage of the population that will just want a sedan or a coupe, no matter what.
Right, and we've talked before about the SUVs and the crossovers, and part of the appeal of those is that they sit a little higher, and many of them have all-wheel drive. So in our climate, for instance, an all-wheel drive car is going to sell maybe a little bit better than a non-all-wheel drive car. But you know what? I wouldn't be surprised to see more and more of the cars coming out with all-wheel drive, and Subaru obviously for years has been doing all-wheel drive, so they already got that figured out.
You listed a few, the Charger, Mustang, WRX, and while not all of these are sedans, they're certainly well into the sedan slash coupe category. I'm wondering how many are niche cars and how many of the sedans that are left are just, sedan versus some kind of something that makes it appealing, like the WRX is a performance sedan or the Charger is kind of performance slash nostalgia. Same thing with the Mustang. Does there have to be some kind of catch with these to get them to sell?
No, and I think that's the funny part is that for the Ford and the Chrysler, it really is that nostalgia, retro name and look, and somewhat the same for the Camaro, obviously, for Chevy. But when I look down the list of the top 12 cars from this last year, all of them are just normal everyday vehicles that you would think, your neighbor has or you have. And, just a quick rundown. We got Camry, Civic, Corolla, Accord, Altima, Sentra, Hyundai Elantra, and then the Fusion Cruise and Focus, but they're being phased out. Malibu is in there, and Chevy is keeping that, and the Kia Forte. And then there's another 8 or 10 right after that that are all normal cars that, they have been fairly current. And Optima now has a hybrid, I know that. These are all nice cars that do the job to get you to and from work and wherever you need to go. And, I don't know if there's an image that crossovers and SUVs have still. Is that, do you still think of it as a sport utility vehicle? Is it sporty? Is it – what's making it sporty? I don't get that. So they're trucks with four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive, and that's nice, and that helps in certain climates.
All right, Mark. I'm glad we talked about sedans. I think they're not getting enough attention for sure.
I think they are not either. And like I say, that everybody should always be looking what's not the most popular thing at the moment, because I bet that's a pretty good value.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Thank you.
You'll find Mark Savage's latest auto review on the Nissan Leaf at WUWM.com and on his website, SavageOnWheels.com. Savage is also editor of Scale Auto Magazine, part of Kalmbach Publishing in Waukesha. He joins contributor Dan Harmon regularly to talk about cars, and you can explore their past segments at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.